You might turn your Bibles to Judges chapter 18. Judges 18.
Encouragement to each other. You've already been an encouragement to me. Everybody seems excited to be here. Everybody was singing out. I really appreciate that. And glad we can be together to study from God's Word. We're in a section of the book of Judges that is one of the more depressing, maybe we would say, but it's at least dark sections, maybe of the whole Bible. And the reason we've been in the book of Judges for a while, and we even went to 1 Samuel for a little while, and the reason that we're looking at these episodes is because they don't fit chronologically in order as they come in the book of Judges. And in fact, chapters 19 through 21, which hopefully we'll look at tonight, actually seem to happen pretty early on in the book of Judges. And we might make note of this again later. But they're... There are some indications that some of these things are happening pretty early on in the period of the book of Judges. So what these indicate to us then is that this is the nature of the period. Unfortunately, that's the way that it looks. And so when we look at some of them are brighter than others, but when we look at some of these bright moments with the judges where you've got God raising up a deliverer, and you have people maybe rallying around that judge in order to save the people, it looks like those are exceptions, not the rule, especially when we think about the fact that some of these things are happening early on in the judge period, and then we certainly see how things get at the end of the book of Judges, and it just all looks pretty dark. And the reason for that is because of the influence of the Canaanites that are around them, and because of the willingness of the Israelites to embrace that influence and to not take the measures that God has put in place in order to restrict that influence. And we really see that, I think, as we open up and look at Judges chapter 17, which is where Micah, who he's an Israelite, but he establishes this shrine in his house, and then he gets a Levite, somebody who's supposed to be a teacher of the law, he gets him to come in and serve in this shrine as a priest. And at the end of the chapter, this is a pretty sad note, in verse 13, he says, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I've got a Levite as priest." As if that's what mattered, having the institution of a Levite represented in his shrine. What mattered was faithfulness. What mattered was keeping the covenant. And so there's so many things in Israel here where we just have, they're just mixed up. They're just confused about what it looks like to serve God faithfully. And it's because they hadn't done it in so long. They hadn't really tried to serve God in so long. So that even when they kind of make these half-hearted attempts, they look horrible. You know, they're making gold, they're making silver shrines to worship the Lord. Well, chapter 18 is going to be the conclusion of that for Micah. For Micah. I did that again. For Micah, just not the countertops. There's going to be the conclusion regarding Micah, and we'll come back to him at the very end. But then in addition to that, we're going to have the Danites who come into this. And so what we've got in chapter 17 and 18 is this kind of large episode that illustrates how dark the period of the judges really were. And so if you're just kind of, I see we have visitors here, so if you're just jumping in with us, that's what these, you know, this is not typical of, maybe it is typical of the people of Israel, but it's a dark period. And so we're coming at this from the perspective of, this is how bad it gets when you take God out of the picture. So in chapter 18, there was no king in Israel. We open up with that sentiment in verse 1. And the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. For unto them the inheritance among the tribes of Israel, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. Does anybody say Lot? He's right here, Chloe, in the middle. Does anybody say Lot? No Lot had fallen to them or something like that? Or does everybody say inheritance?
One says land.
Land, okay. Now, did Dan have a territory allotted to them? Absolutely. It's on the map, so yes, that's the answer. Yeah, Dan had territory that was allotted to them. So why had no territory fallen to them? Yes, that's exactly right. They had actually been pushed out of at least a large part of their territory because Ekron is one of the major cities of the Philistines. We read about that when we're talking about Samson and even when we're talking about Samuel. And so they had been pushed out of it. And Lonnie said they had no faith. And that's right, because it wasn't a matter of their strength or of the Philistines' strength. That really didn't matter because they could be weak and they could still win if God was on their side. It wasn't a matter of whether or not God wanted to be on their side. He did. He wanted to drive out the Philistines for them. But they didn't trust him. And so they weren't even willing to fight. And so they're driven back. And so you've got this tribe of Dan who says, we don't have an inheritance. We need to find somewhere. So this is the people of Dan sent 5 able men. This is the end of verse 2. Go and explore the land. And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. We'll get that in just a second. But the idea here is, well, we can't have this land where we are, so let's go find some land. Was that the right response to the fact that they didn't have any land yet? That's exactly right. Yes. So a faithful tribe of Dan would have said, boys, we have not been doing what we've supposed to been doing up to this point. Let's get our act together. Let's get these Philistines out of here. Let's get the inheritance God has intended for us, because that's what he meant for us all along. But instead, they say, let's go find something that's going to be easier to get. And that's exactly what they do by hook and by crook. Well, anyway, these other fellows, they come to Micah. And when they're there in Micah's house, they come across this Levite, and lo and behold, they've met before, right? What are the chances? Maybe it's providence. I'm just kidding. They recognize the voice of Levite. What brought you here? He says, I'm serving in this shrine. He's hired me. I've become his priest. And they say, will you pray and see if we're going to succeed on this journey? And the priest said to him, go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord. Now, I'm very suspicious about this Levite's advice here. Now, Dan ends up doing what, from their perspective, probably looks like success, right? They're gonna find what they're looking for. But whether or not this Levite had any connection to the Lord and actually getting a message from him, I have no idea, because Micah and his mother in chapter 17 just throw around the name of the Lord as if, you know, as if everything is blessed by the Lord. And so the fact that this Levite's saying something else is blessed by the Lord, when we really don't have any idea. I'm suspicious about that. But anyway, so where do the people of Dan come to? What city do they find? Laish, yes. It's up here. I thought I had raised it or lowered it enough, but you can see it right there, Laish, Dan. It was Laish, and it would become Dan because of what we're going to talk about tonight. Now, what was the nature of this city of Laish? What was the character of the people there? Yeah, laid back, peaceful, didn't bother anybody. They were actually part of the Sidonians who lived over here on the coast. I don't know why I called off Sidon, because that would have been a helpful place to have up here. But they were actually from Sidon. And so if you... But they were pretty distant from them. It wasn't like they had a lot of regular contact. So that was kind of their home country or their home city, but they had spread out over here. And so they're not, this is how they're described in verse 7. They lived in security, quiet, unsuspecting, lacking nothing that's in the earth, and possessing wealth, and how far they were from the Sidonians, and had no dealings with anyone. So they're isolationists, and they're pretty peaceful overall. Now, this looks like a great place to these scouts for Dan. This is a place that, first of all, would have plenty of natural resources, it looks like, to be a sufficient place for them to stay. And also, these aren't the big bad Philistines, right? They are just the Laishians. So they can take care of them, they think. And so they go back and they get 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons for war. They set out from Zora and Eshtaol, and they go and they pass from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Now, the five men go and they say, do you know that in these houses there are an ephod, household gods, carved image, and a metal image? Now therefore, consider what you will do. And they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare. How you doing? Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the five men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with the weapons of war. So what happens is these 600 men, on their way to go take the city of Laish, just stop and they take all of Micah's idols. And they take his whole shrine and his ephod and his priest. They take all of it. Because the Levite appears to be just interested in who's going to give him a paycheck. And so now the Danites come through and they offer him something and they say, you come be our priest. And he's like, well, if being a priest for one guy is good, then being a priest for a whole tribe would be even better. And so that's what he goes and he does. And so they tell him to be quiet. And the priest's heart was glad, this verse 20. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. Now, they come, this is verses 21 through 26, Micah comes out, says, what are you doing? You take my gods that I made, and the priest, and go away, and what have I left? How then do you ask me what's the matter with you? Now, do you find something humorous in the idea that he is concerned about his gods that they have taken from him, right? Like, what kind of gods are these if they're just susceptible to being kidnapped by people? These are not the kinds of gods that that you should be worthy of worship. And yet Micah is very upset. I think the writer here is just showing the stupidity of all this, right? Like, hey, you took my gods. It's like, well, you have gods that can be taken. So that's a problem in the first place. It reminds me of what Gideon's dad says to the people after Gideon has torn down the altar to Baal. What does his dad say? He says, let Baal contend for him, right? Baal's big enough. He can take care of him, right? Can't he? But he can't, right? Because he's just an idol. He can't do anything about it. And so Micah couldn't do anything about it, so he just goes back home. So the people of Dan took what Micah had made. Well, what had he made? Well, he'd made idols that weren't even gods. He took the priest, who could be bought for whatever sum of money somebody came along and offered, as long as it was more. And they came to Laish, which couldn't be defended because they were just quiet and unsuspecting people. So when we think about the Danites, I think from their perspective, this was a pretty successful mission, right? They come in, they take Micah's gods, they're going to take the city of Laish. From their perspective, this is pretty successful. But look at what their success is. They steal gods that are not gods. They take a priest that just goes the highest bidder, and they get a city that couldn't defend itself anyway. It's like, what kind of real success is this, right? This is the cheapest kind of success that there is. And so anyway, they come and they name the city Dan, and they set up a carved image. And notice this, Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests of the tribe of the Danites until the captivity of the land.
I'll just mention, since I know a lot of us use New King James.
Yeah.
New King James says Manasseh.
Oh, okay, yeah.
With a footnote,
yes.
Moses.
Okay, yeah, and mine says Moses with a footnote Manasseh. So, you know. I think the most reading is Moses. Well, it's kind of like having a Levite serving, right? It's like, well, we've got a descendant of Moses serving. So we must be on pretty good footing if Moses' descendant is the one who's watching over these household idols, and that doesn't do them any good either. Or if it's the person of Manasseh, it doesn't matter either. It doesn't do them any good. This is interesting to me because Dan will become the place where Jeroboam sets up one of the golden calves in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 29. And I don't know if this played into his decision at all, but he would have a long history of people worshiping idols in Dan, right? There wouldn't have been a whole lot of uproar about it because Dan's been an idolatrous people ever since they lived in Laish, you know? And so to set up a shrine there probably didn't cause a big stir. And so the ultimate end of this, well, it's a judgment on Micah is judged, you know, all of this stuff is taken away from him. But ultimately, Dan's going to be judged for this too. They're going to be taken into captivity. Notice that it says at the end of verse 30, to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. Well, that's ominous statement, right? Okay, so verse 31. So they set up Micah's carved image they made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. And so it's like they're setting this up in contrast to where the tabernacle is, to where God is really being worshipped. Now let's think about this for a minute. Dan, from all appearances, in the immediate future, looks to be having success. But present success isn't a measure of real success. Because we know what God says about all these things that they're doing. And all the things they're doing, God says, are an abomination, and they're going to be cursed for this. And so things look to be, I mean, if you were in Dan at the time, you'd say things have never been better for Dan. But God looks at this and says, things have never been worse in the history of Israel. Any thoughts on chapter 17 and 18? I know we were kind of picking up halfway in the middle of one and picking up with another. That's right.
They would be the first to go.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great point. Yeah, they thought it was a strategic place. They would have been safer down there by Benjamin and Judah. At least they lasted a little longer, huh? Okay, so again, chapter 19 through 21 is another series of episodes that's all kind of contained. And we get an indication that we're starting a new set of material with this idea. In those days, there was no king in Israel. We get that refrain repeated again. And that should indicate to us that the things that are about to happen, things are not as they should be. Go ahead. Yes.
Before you
absolutely
start the story, let me just make a contrast here.
Yeah.
So you have this story about Micah, and there's almost, it's so wrong that it's almost common.
Mm-hmm.
As you go through here, you see the name of the Lord thrown around it, and there's just no understanding at all. But that's light feeling compared to what we're about to see.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the purpose of this wasn't to show, here are all these things that we look at and we say, oh, how could they be so silly?
Yeah.
And now we're going to get to see something that just breaks your heart.
Yeah.
I mean, just absolutely breaks your heart.
That's right.
And this is what happens, as you said, when God's out.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so remember, these are just episodes. So if they kind of feel like just kind of plucked out and then just placed here, well, they kind of are. These are like appendices to the book of Judges. They're just giving us a feeling of what the period was like. So in chapter 19, and we won't read every account of this. I'm going to do a lot of summarizing. There is a man who has a concubine. Throughout chapter 19, she's referred to variously as a wife and a concubine. And he's referred to sometimes as her husband, and then sometimes as a master. And I wonder, it may be that as you read through, depending on the circumstances, is how he's treating her is how the record reflects on him. So when he's maybe in his softer side, it calls him husband, and then when he's not softer, when he's harsh and whatever, maybe it refers to him as a master. I'm not sure if that's consistent all the way through, but there are certain places where he certainly wants to paint himself in the best terms. And anyway, so a concubine was a wife, but it was probably a wife that her family did not pay as large of a dowry, so she would be lower on the totem pole than a wife whose family paid a large dowry. And the relationship was more like master-slave than it was husband-wife along the way. And what happens is this wife, this concubine, runs away from her husband. And some texts will say she was unfaithful, and some say she was angry with. I don't know exactly what's going on here, my text reads that she's being unfaithful, but whatever it is, whether she's unfaithful or she's angry, she runs away to her father's house, and the Levite comes to woo her back, right, to win her back. And so he comes to the father's house. The father is happy to see her, and his father-in-law made him stay 3 days. So he eats and drinks and spends the night. The fourth day, they get up early in the morning, and the father-in-law says, oh, don't go yet. Stick around for a little while. And he said, okay, I will. And then, oh, it's getting too late. You just need to stay the night. So he stays the night. And then on the fifth day, he does the same thing. He gets up early in the morning. Oh, it's too early. Stay here, have a bite to eat. And then he's like, oh, but the day is waning towards evening. You don't need to go. Well, you say, what's all this about? Well, finally, the man says, well, we got to go. We're leaving. We're not staying any longer. But we know that the day is waning towards evening. And so they're not going to be able to make it very far before they're going to have to stop for the night. And so the man wouldn't spend the night. This is verse 10. He rose up, he departed, and he arrives opposite, I'm going to call it Jebus. I don't know if that's right. The natural inclination is to call it Jebus, but I think it's Jebus because they're the Jebusites. But anyway, that is Jerusalem. I guess we could just call it Jerusalem. And he had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. Notice how she's just kind of listed among the items that he has with him. So I think this is one of those places where the writer is kind of giving us a clue as to his attitude towards her. He comes to woo her back and win her over. But now that he has her, she's just with the saddled donkeys, right? She's just in the train. And when they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over. And the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside in the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah." So he doesn't want to stop in Jebus. Do you have any idea why he wouldn't want to stop? I mean, he explains it some, but what? Those ungodly people. They're immoral. Who knows what will happen to us if we stop in the city of the Jebusites, right? You know, we don't know those people. They're not like us. If we stop there, we may, you know, something terrible may happen. And so they make their way to Gibeah, and they say, we'll spend the night at Gibeah or Ramah. And so they pass through. They come to Gibeah, which is in the tribe of Benjamin. You can see just right across the border there. And so he goes, and he's going to spend the night in, he's in the open square, and it looks to me like they're planning on kind of staying the night out there. And that was not an uncommon thing to do. The square was kind of an open area where people who were traveling could just kind of lay a pallet out on the ground and stay there for the night. It wasn't uncommon. But this old man comes, and he sees what they're planning on doing, and he says, "Please do not stay in the square." What does this sound like? What account does this echo? Sodom, right? So we know what happens to Sodom. Sodom is an ungodly city, immoral, and they're destroyed. And the picture that's being painted here is that this city of Gibeah, which is in the tribe of Benjamin, is like Sodom. This old man comes in, and he's kind of the lot of this picture, where he says, "Come stay with me, don't stay out in the open square." And he says, "I'll take care of all you want, just don't spend the night in the square." So verse 21, he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Well, this seems all right so far. But then, in the middle of the night, as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, beating on the door, and they said to the old man, the master of the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him." So not only is kind of the context being set up to make it sound like Sodom, the sin that these men want to commit is exactly the same thing that the men of Sodom were demanding. And then you're going to hear even more echoes, because the old man says, "No, don't take him," because the idea is, I'm trying to be hospitable to him. Don't take the guy that I brought into my house to take care of. But I have a virgin daughter, and he has his concubine. You take them. Well, some kind of hospitality, right? Like this is wretched. This is his solution to the issue. And what kind of solution is this? But they wouldn't listen. So the man, I take this to be the Levite, because it says, took his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the day began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. So she comes and she falls down in front of the door. And the master, the husband, gets up the next morning, sees her laying at the threshold, and says, "Get up, let's go." And so he is presented as apathetic, right? Evidently he goes to bed with whatever's going on. She's laying at the threshold until light. So there's a period of time where she's there and he doesn't bring her in. And then when it's time to go, he just says, "Get up, let's go." And so every person in this is indicted, right? Every person in this is doing something they ought not be doing. The only person who might have an exception is the concubine. And depending on whether or not her unfaithfulness led her to where she was, the point is that nobody is moral in this. Nobody is what they ought to be in this. And so he gets back to his house. He carries her on the donkey, dead, I suppose. I assume she's dead. And he cuts her in pieces and sends 12 pieces throughout Israel. And the commentary on this is, such a thing never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak. I wonder, could things have been any worse in Jebus? I mean, how much worse could things get? And this is graphic, and it's gory, and it's awful, and it's in Israel. And that's the point. The point is that this is the depths of the depravity that the people of Israel go when they have rejected Yahweh as God, and when they've embraced. And so he said, we can't stop in a Canaanite city. Well, stopping in Gibeah is not any better. It's like Sodom and Gomorrah. And so in chapter 20, all the people of Israel are riled up about this, and rightfully so. And they unite as one man from Dan to Beersheba, right? From north to south, from Maine to Florida, right? All the way across. They say, we're coming and we're going to do something about this injustice. And they come, and the Levite oversees this assembly, and he says, this is what happened. I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin. I and my concubine to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. Anything missing from that story? Yeah. Yeah. There's a convenient omission there, right? Incensed at the injustice of Gibeah, rightfully so, but conveniently omitting his role in all of that. And so he says, what we need to do is, at the end of verse 7, behold, you people of Israel, give your advice and counsel here. And all the people arose as one man saying, we will not go home until this is taken care of. We're going to destroy Benjamin. I think that is a righteous indignation, right? But think about this. There were other occasions in the book of Judges where righteous indignation would have been the right response. And they don't seem to do anything about it. It's interesting to me that the thing that they get unified on is destroying one of the tribes. They couldn't get unified against the Philistines. They couldn't get unified against the Moabites or the Midianites. But they can get unified against Benjamin. And maybe it's because this is such an egregious thing for an Israelite tribe to do, or for an Israelite city to do, that this has to be stomped out. Maybe they even recognize that this is too far. That's exactly right. Absolutely. Yeah, so 17:6, 21:25, there is no king in Israel. Every man does what's right in his own eyes. And that frames all these stories. This is what happens when everybody's being led by their own impulses. So the people... You're going to say something?
Well, it's really scary, though, about this. We read pretty regular now about people getting cut up in pieces and buried in barrels or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So... they might have been some of the first, but we got some like them.
Right. Yeah.
So you sent that out to get people's attention?
Yes, I think so. I think that's exactly right. Yeah, and so they come together and they say, well, we're going to go to war. They get 400,000 men together. They come down to Gibeah and they tell the Benjamites, you give these people up. Right. Well, what does Benjamin say? No, right? They're going to... aid and abet these people. They're going to provide these people sanctuary. And the people of Israel say, okay, well then you're involved in this too. And so they're going to go to war. 26,000 men, what it says in verse 15. Is that, everybody have that? Okay. 26,000 men and 700 chosen men of Gibeah who were slingshotters. And but the people of Israel have 400,000. So the people of Benjamin are way outnumbered in this. And so the people of Israel, the 400,000, ask, who will go up first for us? Does that sound like anything? Chapter 1, verse 1. The people of Israel ask the Lord, who shall go up first for us? And what's the answer? Judah. Same as the answer was in chapter 1, verse 2. Now that's very similar, right? But the similarities are there to highlight the difference. In chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, who are they rising up to fight against? Well, it was Canaanites, right? It was driving the Canaanites out of their land. Here, who are they asking who's going to go up first for us against? Benjamin, right, against another tribe of Israel. This is how far things have gone. Now, I don't know if there's anything to the fact that Israel doesn't ask the Lord whether or not they should go up against Benjamin. They just ask who should go up first. There are several things that I read and listened to that made a big deal out of that fact. Maybe they should have said, should we even do this in the first place? But from what I understand about like the book of Deuteronomy or something, that when there's a city like this, that's the right response, is to destroy it. And so the question is, who's going to go first? But when they go up first, what happens to Judah? They're defeated, right? They have to retreat. And so this kind of shocks them. You know, God says to go. And then the next day they say, well, shall we draw near again to fight our brothers, the people of Benjamin? So now they're at least questioning whether or not this is something they're supposed to be doing. And what's the response? Go up and fight. But then when they go up and fight the next time, what happens? Defeated again, and they're driven back. And then they ask at the end of verse 28, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? They're wondering if they should stop. And the interesting thing is, here they offer sacrifices, and they fast, and they pray, and they mourn. They are humbled by these two defeats. I mean, 400,000 to 26,700, they are far the superior force, and yet they've been beaten twice. And so this humbles them. And what you see here, I think, is with this response, that it may be that Israel is so depraved that God is using this as a judgment on both Israel and on Benjamin. Israel as a whole is not innocent. And so they're using this as an opportunity to bring judgment on Benjamin, and that's right. They need to be doing that. But until they come and humble themselves and worship God and offer sacrifices and mourn over their sin, until then, and so the next day they go out and then they're victorious. And we'll talk more about that in just a second. Just a chronological note, notice that Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, is the priest. So we've got to be pretty early on in the period, because Eleazar is priest when they come into the land, but he dies and is buried at the end of the book of Joshua. So, you know, this is the next high priest. So it could have been, I don't know what, 80 years, 100 years, or whatever, but we're not talking about a super long time after the beginning of the period of the book of Judges. And so the Lord says, go up tomorrow and I'll give the people into your hand. So here's the indication here is that God hasn't been giving them into their hand up to this point, and now He is. So something changes, and it seems to me that what's changing is the people's attitude towards God in all this. That's about as good as I can do with that, because I don't really know what's happening. One thing that's helpful, if you'll flip over to verse 35 of the same chapter, and the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. We know what God's doing. We just don't really know. I'm just not sure about what path He's taking in order to get there. Right? I know that this is all of God. I'm just not sure what He's doing in each individual circumstance.
You know, you had mentioned the possibility of this being judgment against Israel as well. And in these first two battles, 40,000 Israelite men died in this. And so, but besides the moral tragedy that's taken place here, this is bad times.
Yeah.
This is bad times for Israel in this. And so they're reaping what they've sown in the climate they've created. And you see that in the loss of life here as well. And then 25,000... Probably about to mention this, but 25,000 Benjamites on this. So you're looking at 65,000 Israelites total that are lost.
So I'm just going to kind of summarize this last part. They set an ambush. So the people of Israel attack and then retreat, and then a group of 10,000 come in and burn Gibeah, and then the Gibeonites and the Benjamites who go out are stuck in the middle, and they're killed. And like Lonnie said, 25,100 Benjamites were killed. There's a verse, 19, verse 40. But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven. Very similar language is used to talk about the destruction of Sodom in 1928 of Genesis. So, you know, it goes up in smoke there. Now, there are 600 men that end up being left, verses 47 and 48. And they go and they hide at the Rock of Rimmon. And the people of Israel turn back against the people and have been struck with the edge of the sword. It's the city, men, and beasts, and all that they found, and all the towns that they found that set on fire. It looks to me like at the end of the day, there are 600 Benjaminite men left. Like that's all the tribe of Benjamin that there is. And they're hiding in the Rock of Rimmon. Think about what the tribe of Israel has done to Gibeah. And I especially want to add that to chapter 21 at the first few verses. They make another vow, and what is that vow? Yeah, they're not going to let their children intermarry, their daughters specifically, intermarry with the Benjaminite men. When you see the way that Israel responds to Gibeah and Benjamin here, destroying them because of their wickedness, and then refusing to give their children an intermarriage to them. What does that sound like? Well, who were they supposed to do that with? The Canaanites. Now imagine if we had done this chapter 2, chapter 3. Wouldn't that have been a much different book of Judges, right? It maybe wouldn't be called Judges. It'd be called Joshua Part 2 or something. I don't know what it'd be called. We don't know what it would have been like, except for the fact that they are using the strategies that God said should have been used on the Canaanites, but now they're having to do it to one of their own because one of their own is no different than Canaan. One of their own is no different than the pagans. And so they do make this vow and say, we're not going to give our daughters in marriage to these people. And they take that vow very seriously. But then it seems to be that they have second thoughts. So they've made two vows. They've made a war vow that anybody who doesn't come and help us fight against Benjamin, they deserve to die. Right? That was the first vow. And the second vow is we're not going to give our wives in marriage to... their daughters in marriage to the Benjaminites. But then it's as if they have kind of second thoughts about that and say, we don't want a tribe of the Lord's people to go. You know, then we won't have 12 tribes anymore. We won't have Benjamin anymore. And so what they do is they decide there was this city called Jabesh-Gilead, which was on the other side. We'll talk about this more as we go along. But there's a very close relationship from now on between the tribe of Benjamin and Jabesh-Gilead. Saul will rescue Jabesh-Gilead, and then Jabesh-Gilead will be the city that goes and finds Saul's remains. Saul's from the tribe of Benjamin. And then Jabesh-Gilead will go and find Saul's remains and give it a proper burial. And so there's a kind of a weird relationship from here on out with these two cities. But anyway, so the people go and they say, Jabesh-Gilead didn't come when we called them to go to war. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to kill everything that breathes except for the women there who have never known a man. And so they do that, and they find 400 virgin women, and they say, well, we got to give these to the Benjaminites. Well, that's two-thirds, right? 400 out of 600 are taken care of. Well, what are we going to do for the rest of them? Well, there's this feast at Shiloh, where the tabernacle is. There's this feast, and the women of the city, they come out and they dance in celebration. So what you need to do, Benjaminites, the 200 that are left, you need to hide out in the countryside. And when they come out to dance and celebrate, you just kidnap them and then take them back home and they'll be your wives. And then when their fathers and their brothers come and say, hey, what are you doing? You say, hey, don't worry about it. You didn't give them to us, so you didn't break the vow. We took them. So you just go home and we'll keep our wives and everybody will be happy. And that appears to be exactly what happens. Now, these are the same people who united as one man to attack the city of Gibeah for taking somebody and raping them. And that's exactly what they're doing 200 times over. 200 times over. And so, is it possible, when you think about Jabesh-Gilead, is it possible that they deserved a judgment because they didn't come and help extinguish the wickedness out of Israel? I think so. But the response is ridiculously severe, right? Should there maybe have been done something to help preserve the tribe? I don't know, I guess. They take their vow very seriously, right? It's kind of honorable that they're like, well, we can't give our wives to them, our daughters to them. That's a good thing. And then they're like, well, let's go kidnap some people to do it. The last verse tells us what's going on here. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so you have this confusion. I mean, just baffling confusion about they have some idea of honor and some idea of virtue, and the very moment that they have such debased attitudes about so many other things. And what's going on here is these people have no idea what it looks like to be faithful to God. Because they have been... So the book of Joshua is a story of how Canaan became Israel. The story of Judges is how Israel became Canaan. And it's a wonder that Israel exists at all at this point, right? I mean, because you've got... If it was up to Israel, they would be idolatrous just like Canaan. They would be intermarried with all the Canaanites. They would have ceased to exist as a people because they wanted to be just like everybody else. They want to be just like the Canaanites. If it wasn't for God's care, if it wasn't for His grace, if it wasn't for His watchfulness and all this, they would have ceased to exist. So the very fact that Israel exists at all shows us that God is still working. Even in the darkest of times, that God's still there and He still has a plan and He's going to bring that plan about. And so we're going to move into a new era very soon of the people of Israel. And there's going to be more dark points in the history. And we might wonder at certain points along the way and say, well, is God still there? Does He still care? Does He still have a plan to bless all nations through this people? And if the book of Judges tells us anything, it should tell us that it doesn't matter how dark it gets, that God's still going to bring about His plan. He's still going to carry that out. Now, fascinatingly, I think, when we look to our next book, which will be the book of Ruth, it's another one of those accounts that happens in the period of the book of Judges. We don't exactly know where, but it is as bright a spot as you will see in the period of the Judges, right? I mean, it's a beautiful story of faithfulness. It's a beautiful story of loyalty and of devotion. And it's not an Israelite that is the center of it. It's a Moabite. It's a Moabite that's the center of it. So that tells us something about the darkness of the period of the book of Judges, that we're looking to the other nations in order to have something that will even remotely look like somebody who's faithful to God. And yet God's still working, and we'll see that in the book of Ruth as well. Any thoughts or comments on, especially on these last two chapters, but really on the book of Judges as a whole, because we're coming to an end in that. I know if you're visiting tonight and you just jumped into this class, it was probably like, is that what they talk about every time? It's not. So come back Sunday and Wednesday and we'll talk about Ruth. And it's a lot less ruthless despite the name. So, all right. Thank y'all.